Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to American Statesman Blog Talk Radio. Today is Thursday, May 31st, 2012. My name is Sally Baptist. I'll be hosting the show tonight. My co-host is Charlie Klein. He'll be joining us momentarily. Here at American Statesman, it's all about duty, honor, and country. Here at American Statesman, we believe the biggest problem really facing America today is the invasion of the politician. We have those that sit in public office today. They get elected, with our help, of course, they get elected to public office, and then they just seem to take on a total split personality, the King George syndrome, whatever you want to call it. They forget that they're there supposed to be serving us, that we are the masters and they are the servants. But they get confused. They have an identity crisis. They all of a sudden think it's all about them, and they can do whatever they want. And, you know, a thing called the Constitution, who cares? You know, what's that about? We don't need a Constitution, do we? You know, they just make up the rules as they go. And so we here at the American Statesman Blog Talk Radio contend that it's the politician that is our biggest threat to this country, to the sovereignty of this country. It's not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, we can see the enemy, we understand the enemy. It's the insiders, the ones that are killing us from within, that are destroying our economy, making the country go bankrupt. It's the politician. The politician who goes out there with a facade of one thing and ends up being something totally, totally different. So it's that's what we're facing here, and that's what American Statesman Blog Talk Radio is all about. We're here to deal with the issues. We're here to talk about the facts. We're here to get people engaged in doing something to make a difference. Today, we're going to give you an update on the FBI complaint. We've been talking a lot. We've got several different issues that we're out there working on with different groups across the country. We're working with Arizona on helping to get Obama removed, and there's actually some information. I'll try to dig it up before the end of the show to let you know that there is a challenge going on here in Florida about having Obama removed on the ballot, so he is not going to be allowed on the ballot in 2012. I'm going to look up the details and give you an update on that before we go tonight. Then there's the fact is, nationwide, there's a campaign to take back America this Memorial Day, 2012, to go out there and demand from Congress and from your states that they follow the Constitution and remove Obama because he's there illegally. He openly admits himself he was born in Kenya. He is not a natural-born citizen, and so he does not belong in that office. So that's another issue. And then the other thing tonight, which is where we're going to spend most of our time, starting at about 7:30, Byron Donalds, he is a go candidate for Congress, District 14 here in Florida. Byron Donalds, a go candidate. And for those of you who are not familiar with go, which it's spelled G-O-O-O-H, get out of our house. You can go to go.com, G-O-O-H.com, or you can go to the Florida site, which is G-O-O-H-F-L.com, and find out more about it. But basically, go is a process for citizens of a congressional district to pick their own candidate. Who do they want to be the candidate? Instead of having the political parties tell you who's going to be the candidate, you from the congressional district decide who you want to support. And it's a process you go through. And Byron's going to be on with us. We're going to go through it a little bit with him. He can explain what it was like to be selected as the GO candidate. And GO just recently came out with a bumper sticker that I think is really good. It says, right below where it says go.com, do something. Do something. That's what GO is about. Do something. And then on the side, it's a little checkbox, Republican, Democrat, fed up. Well, we're checking off fed up. So this isn't about Democrats or Republicans. It's about citizens being fed up with the status quo of politicians we have today. And that when we get Byron on, we're going to talk to him. We're going to ask him the tough questions. We got a list of questions he's not going to be able to run from, which he already knows. Anybody who comes on to American Statesman Blog Talk Radio knows we are going to ask the tough questions. And we're going to, because this is non-commercialized, There's no interruptions for commercials to the, you know, you're not going to get a 5-second blip of an answer. We're going to have, Byron's going to have time to talk and tell us why he's the best person for the job. So tonight's going to be a very good show, and this is our first GO candidate, so I'm really excited to have Byron on. And then the other part of it, we have the chat room open, so go out there, and if you have questions and comments you want to submit, during the show, you're welcome to put them in the chat room, and I'll get to them and ask Byron for you, or, you know, if there's anything else you want to talk about. And then the other is call in. You can call into the show, 347-857-4364. That's 347-857-4364. And make sure you press 1 to be placed in the queue, in the host queue. If you do not press 1, we think you're just out there listening, and we're not ignoring you. We're just not going to bother you. We'll leave you to listen. So make sure you press the 1 if you want to speak. And I see we have some people out there already who are wanting to get into the discussion. But the first things first, I got to get Charlie Klein on. Charlie's going to give us a brief update on the FBI complaint, what's happening with that. And then we'll see what else the other people are wanting to talk about. And then, like I say, at the bottom of the hour, we have Byron Donalds coming on as the GO candidate. So, on that note, let's get the show started. Okay, Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, but I got to do a spell check on you.
Oops, what did I spell GO wrong?
You sure did.
I leave out one of the O's?
You left the last O out on both of them.
Oops, GO.
G-O-O-H. H. Three O's.
Yes.
G-O-O-H.
Get out of our house.
That's
get
right.
Get out of our house. Sorry about that. I guess I was going too fast here. We've got so much
that's
to cover
right.
tonight. I had to hurry and get going.
Well, I'm going to be quick because you have callers in. Actually, I think we ought to just go and ask the callers and put them on that want to speak because they may not have the time to wait. We can always come back to this later. So once you can put them on.
Okay, so you don't want to give us your update on the FBI complaint. Okay,
The FBI complaint is 1 month old as of Monday, and then Sally and I will be discussing what we are going to do with it. We may decide and go file it in the federal courts, but we are going to get some more expert commentary on it from some of our fellow patriots to make sure that we do it in the right manner. Okay.
Okay, and I'm going to go to the caller, the last four digits, 3320. Caller, 3320, you're on the air. Can I get your name, please?
Hey, Sally, this is Keith.
Hey,
oh.
Keith. I thought I recognized that number. I should have recognized it by now.
Actually, I wasn't sure what time you were going to have Byron on, and I just decided to call in and listen to your show, so I don't really have much to comment on, but I'm available if you need me to, okay?
Okay, well, when Byron gets on, we'll go to you because you'll probably have a few questions for him, too.
Okay.
Okay, we'll get back to you. Thanks. Okay, and then I do see another in, let's see here. The last four digits are 1840. 1840. You're on the air. 1840, the last four digits. Can I have your name, please? Hello? Well, I think they may have their mute button on, so we will hold off on them. So we'll see if they come back. Okay, well, while we're waiting for, this is 1840, last four digits, 1840, to speak up, and it could actually be someone from Byron's campaign. I'm not sure.
Okay.
It doesn't show their name, but we can go ahead and talk a little bit more. We had some people asking us about the FBI complaint, and what they should do, and if they should file one, and some things like that. So why don't you go ahead and talk about that until we have this other person come online.
Well, as far as Sally and I have always said, when we filed this complaint with the FBI, we did it for the good of America. We did not do it on a personal basis, but we did it based on the rules and the laws of the state of Florida that really are probably the highest filing fees in the nation, $10,440 to file to run for office as a member of Congress. And of that, the executive committee of the parties gets about two-thirds of that money, and there is nothing in the Constitution that authorizes either party, Republican, Democrat, or any other party, the right to operate or control the ballot box of the people. The ballot box of the people belongs to we the people. It is paid for by taxes. It is not paid for by a toll or a poll tax. But it is apparent that the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, who are in control of the legislature of the state of Florida, decided to make it impossible for the average American to run for office. Because a person who works for, say, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year may have, does have all of the qualifications to be a representative. They just don't have the money to run for office. And now it has been proved that the Democrat Party and the Republican Party, working in collusion with the state legislatures, etc., have developed rules and regulations to keep the average American out, and therefore that is why Sally and I filed this complaint, because we accuse the Republican Party and the Democrat Party et al. Of being creating illegal monopolies, thus keeping out competition. And therefore, they are in violation of the Hobbs Act, the Clayton Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act. And so, ladies and gentlemen, if you are in a position where you want to go ahead and file this complaint, we suggest that you go over it for your state to make sure that you can file it in your state, because some of the rules and regulations and some of the evidence that we have is purely for the state of Florida, such as the Wagner versus Gray, which was adjudicated by the Florida Supreme Court in 1954, stating that a primary election is not for the election of people into office, but that it is an election so that the Democrat and Republican parties or any other party can select their nominees to be put on the general ballot. But yet, in the state of Florida, people have been elected to office in the primary, which is a violation of the Florida Supreme Court ruling. But getting around to this, ladies and gentlemen, we are always getting information from people here at American Statesman, from other patriots across this country. And somebody sent us something that's very interesting, and it really applies to you in every other state. And I'm just going to read on it, and it has to do with fiduciary. Fiduciary, a person having a legal duty created by his undertaking to act primarily for the benefit of another in matters connected with his undertaking, such as an attorney has a fiduciary relationship with a client. Now, that's quite interesting, because all the members of Congress and the Senate are in a fiduciary responsibility to we the people, because we rely on them to do the job in our best interest. Now, how many violations do you think you can come up with that our elected representatives have failed to, how would you say, protect us? How about the fact that there was something going on in Libya? It was a violation of the Constitution. How about the fact that they failed to close the border to stop illegal drugs from coming into the United States and to stop illegal aliens? How about the fiduciary responsibility to spend your money properly and in the best interest of we the people? And they are giving it to people who are here illegally. Illegal aliens getting housing, food stamps, and schooling, health care. And Congress doesn't act to do anything about it, because a lot of these people work for their friends who make donations to their campaigns. I'm accusing them of that. But everything about this fiduciary means they are supposed to be working in the best interest of we the people of the United States of America, and that is where they are supposed to spend the money properly. It is not to be given to somebody on a personal note in any way, shape, or form, because that is the definition of it. And you can get the definition of fiduciary responsibility by going to Black's Law Dictionary, 7th edition. Because these are all taken from Black's Law Dictionary, 7th edition. A fiduciary duty of utmost good faith, trust, confidence, and candor owed by a fiduciary to the beneficiary, a duty to act with the highest degree of honesty and loyalty toward another person, and that other person happens to be we, the people, when it comes to those who we elect into office on a federal, state, and local level. So here in the state of Central Florida, we, the people, said no to a rail system for commuter travel. Seven people violated their fiduciary responsibilities to we, the people, and said, and are shoving a rail system down our throat with the, how would you say, backing of one, Congressman John Mica, who is also in violation of his fiduciary responsibilities to uphold our constitutional rights of the people. So, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who would like to take this FBI complaint and run with it in your area, do so with our blessing. Just do it for your state and make sure you're doing it for the good of all Americans in this great country of America. This is one way of helping to restore honesty in our government, because once this case gets going in the courts, you have to watch out for one thing. You have to immediately make sure that the court puts an injunction against all future expenditures and income of the Democrat Party and the Republican Party and all of those associated with it. You have to stop them, and therefore you need an injunction against them. However, the facts are in the complaint, and the FBI has the evidence. The evidence is in what the legislature has done. And the legislature may have tied us, we the people, into going through civil court. And if that be the case, then those legislators are going to be in for a wild ride in the courthouse, because they're the ones who have violated your rights. And your rights are violated under 18 U.S.C.A. 241. That's right, the United States Code, called Conspiracy Against Rights. If two or more people intimidate, coerce, harass any other individual in the free exercise of their rights. Let me get that straight now. If two or more persons conspire to injure, oppress, threaten, or intimidate any person in any state, territory, commonwealth, possession, or district in the free exercise or enjoyment of any right or privilege secured to him by the Constitution or laws of the United States, or because of his having so exercised the same, they shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both. So, violating your rights to enjoy your money because they decide to spend the money on foreigners in other places, and also like Solyndra, giving money out to personal people who have contributed heavily to campaigns, and it's your money, they have actually violated your rights. So the laws that have been made are actually helping we the people. We just have to get off of the couch and take the action necessary. And that's where the GO process is there to help you. That's getoutofourhouse.com. AmericanStatesman.org, SaveAmericaFoundation.com, and TheArizonaSentinel.com. I suggest you go to all of them and get involved if you want your freedoms to remain intact. Okay, Sally, back to you.
Yep, and that's the whole reason why we did this complaint with the FBI. We the people versus the ballot box establishment. The parties and the process has been so corrupted that we the people are denied any representation. We are denied the representation of our choice. And so when these people get in there, they're not representing us. They're representing everybody but us. And that's why GO is so important. And that's why, you know, looking forward again to when we get Byron Donalds here on the call, on the show. He's we're going to get into what it was like to be a GO candidate, the vetting process. And, I mean, you just don't go and get to be a GO candidate. You have to go through a process. You have to make a commitment to the people. It's a whole different way of selecting representation and getting people on the ballot. And it's not about the party. It's totally opposite. The party only comes into play as a strategy of how you're going to get on the ballot and how you're going to win the primary. Because if you're running against an incumbent, half the time the incumbents don't even have to be opposing them anymore, which is even more disgusting. But, you know, if you're running and the incumbent is a Democrat, then run in the primary as a Democrat against the incumbent. Or if you're running, if the incumbent happens to be a Republican, because we know that the core, the truth is, the people who are running for public office, you know, this game that they play with the D's and the R's, it doesn't mean anything. It's all a big melting pot. They run under whatever they think they have a better chance to try to win. So from the GO perspective, we go through the congressional district, the people of a district go through a process to select somebody they believe in, and they want to help them get elected. So it's not about party. You could truly technically run as a no-party affiliate, and if Florida, in the case of Florida, if Florida had open primaries, which it doesn't, if it had open primaries, you could run as a no-party affiliate, and I believe that a lot would happen, and I believe we would see much more of a trend. But because the political parties have, again, monopolized this process and corrupted it, especially here in Florida, that you can't do that. If you run as a no-party affiliate, you have to wait until the general election, and then there might be 10 of you out there. You are totally blocked from participating in the primary, even though they have nonpartisan races in a primary that they elect people in. Florida is so corrupt in its process. The process, so anybody who's running for any kind of state office in Florida, you really need to challenge them on the election process. You need to force the, you know, try to go through the GO process to select your candidates for the Florida House and Senate, too, if you'd like, because the process is good across the board. But we really, in Florida, it is so desperate. The process is so corrupt. I know because I ran for public office here. I ran for a county office. Charlie knows because he ran as the write-in candidate for Congress at one point. The process has been so corrupted. And the other part, too, we tried to explain to people, why did you do this, or what do you think you're going to accomplish, whatever. You know, we don't stand a chance of taking back this country if we can't elect people of ethics and integrity. And right now we can't. We don't have the representation of our choice. We are denied electing the representation of our choice because the parties, the political parties in collusion with various governmental offices and, of course, the media, we'll talk about the media here in just a minute, they have gerrymandered this system so badly so that they have full control and the same people stay in there. We have no representation today. Anybody that thinks we have representation today, you must be sipping some really interesting Kool-Aid or drugs or something, whatever. You're doing something, but you're obviously got your head buried in the sand and you're not facing the reality. The other piece, which the mentioning the media, we have the FCC case. It's FCC Reg 99-390, which is serve the public interest. So cable news is different. So when we're talking about this, cable news is just as bad, but they are in a slightly different scenario than the typical networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, and the local Fox News, Fox affiliates. Those networks and their affiliates, they are licensed under FCC and are obligated to meet that criteria, serve the public interest. So anything to do with elections and politics, does it really rocket science to see that they have failed to serve the public interest? And it's not only that they fail to serve the public interest, they go against the public interest because they falsify their reporting. They conveniently pick and choose their winners. They conveniently leave out details and facts about the elections and the process, the delegates, the conventions, how a presidential an individual is nominated for the presidential nominee for the Republican Party, as the most common one that's today, that's, or I should say, most obvious one. So they they selectively decide how they want to report stuff to manipulate the outcome of the elections. That is, you can call it conspiracy. They conspire with the political parties. You can call it collusion. They are in collusion to influence an outcome of the elections. Whatever you want to call it, it's all the same thing, and it's a violation of FCC 99-390, serve the public interest. They lie. They falsely report. They omit the facts. Whenever they said that Romney had locked up the nomination, that was a lie. That's a lie. That's not what the rules are. They totally misrepresent what the rules are for the National Convention, and the fact that they refused to cover Ron Paul's events, campaign events, while they were covering Romney's is also a lie. It's misrepresenting the facts. The fact is there were more people rallying around Ron Paul than there were Romney. But the media, in cahoots with the RNC and the DNC, the political parties, and, of course, those of the local, in this case here, it would be the Florida Republican Party, Republican Party of Florida, and these various entities. That is, that's conspiracy. That's collusion. Call it what you want to, but it's a lie, and it's a violation of FCC regs. So that's another thing that we need to remember as part of this process, and that's another reason why we came up with the ballot box establishment. The ballot box establishment is any of these entities that are involved, the individual, the entity, the organization that's involved in this election process. They're the ones who have decided that they have the right to take over the election process and that you and me, we the people, the voters, are in fact we the sheeple. They're making us the sheeple whether we want to be or not. Well, I refuse to be a sheeple, so that's why I'm here talking about it. And same with Charlie. We refuse to be sheeple. We're not going to put up with this garbage. We're going to demand that these people do their job and actually follow the Constitution. Rubio, what are you out there doing on the campaign trail? Every day they spend all their time out there on the campaign trail, that should be deducted from their pay. We are not paying them to be on the campaign trail. Rubio is not running for his own reelection. This is him trying to help Romney to get elected. But it's a process across the board. It's not just Rubio doing this, so he's just one of them. But you know what? Let's make them clock in. Let's give them an hourly rate. Okay, you guys are going to make, we'll double your, just for the fun of it, we'll double the minimum wage, which puts them up to around $15-16 an hour, I guess, somewhere in there. We'll double the hourly minimum wage, and that's how much you get paid when you actually clock in and do your job. And by the way, you don't get any pension plan either. And by the way, you have to pay for your own health care. You know, let's start getting our money's worth from these people, because I'm so sick of them flying all over the place and doing everything but their job while we have to pay these crazy salaries they get. But anyway, I'm kind of getting off course there. That part just annoys me that I do that. But the whole point is we have to get people in public office that represent us. We've got to get them to honor the oath of office that they took, which means following the Constitution. Does anybody want to venture a guess of how many pieces of the Constitution are violated every day? I mean, I can't even begin to imagine. I really can't. Ron Paul probably has a list of them, but I can't even imagine. But we know there's many of them.
The Constitution?
Yes.
The Constitution of the United States of America was to protect the people from the tyrants that we elect into office. And if we allow anybody in office to violate our constitutional rights, which we have allowed, then we are our own worst enemies, and now we have to take it back because they were not supposed to take advantage of us because they are in violation of their fiduciary responsibility to work for we the people since we are paying them their wages. They are failing to represent us, so they are violating the Constitution. And when you violate the Constitution, you violate your fiduciary responsibility to not only we the people of America, but to America itself. That's the way I look at it, and I'm going to stick with my story. It's time to make changes in Washington, and if we don't make them by November, then that means we're going to have to take action and put them where they belong, behind bars, because they have violated the Constitution with the Patriot Act, and with the National Defense Authorization Act. You do not make any laws abridging the freedom of speech, the freedom of assembly, or anything. And they have done that. Because when they cordon off an area because people want to demonstrate someplace because they're upset, and they cordon it off and say you can only do it in certain areas, and I don't care when it is, instead of cordoning off the people, they can go ahead and do something else. But they do not violate the rights of the people. The way they can correct things is by being honest and of the highest integrity. Then they won't have anybody complaining. There will be no reason for people to, how would you say, assemble and complain. Honesty is the best policy.
And on that note.
Yep, let's go.
And on that note, we have Byron here, so we are going to go to the GO candidate, the Florida GO candidate for Congressional District 14. I think, unless it's changed, I think it's 14. And he is here with us right now, Byron Donalds. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. By the way, it has changed. It's Congressional District 19 now.
19, okay. Okay, sorry about that.
That's okay, that's all right.
Okay, well, as we told you, this is no commercials. We're going to give you plenty of time to tell us who you are and why, and then we're going to take some time to ask you some of the tough questions. And also, at the top of the show, we were explaining a little bit about what the GO process is. So you go ahead and please introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about you, I Still Believe, and then we'll get into a little bit about what it was like being a GO candidate, and then we'll go get into the details of some of the tough questions for you.
Well, my name is Byron Donalds. I'm running for the United States Congress in Congressional District 19, which is in Southwest Florida. It's Collier County and Lee County, Florida. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York. I'm the product of a single-parent household. I have a degree in finance and marketing from Florida State University. I'm currently a husband. I've been married to my wife for almost 10 years. We have 3 children. They're 8, 4, and 1, and just turned 1, actually. I have all boys. I've worked in banking and in investments for the almost 10 years in Southwest Florida. I'm a member of the Naples Tea Party Leadership Council. Since 2010, I've given speeches about where we are as a nation, why liberty is important. I gave a speech in the community referencing the important issues facing the Constitution, both historically and today. I'm a citizen. I'm just a regular citizen. I still work while I campaign. I'm actually the only person in the race who's doing that, who works full-time and campaigns full-time. I have a family, and I'm very, very concerned about the future of this nation. I'm really a student of history, also being a man of math, if you will. And the one thing I quickly realized in doing a lot of economic analysis, which I've done in my career, is that if we don't get a handle on this government soon, it's really going to be lights out for the country. I mean, we're really that close to the precipice. And if you really start to think through not just the political philosophy of how we got here, but what it's going to take to reverse course, we cannot have the same old and think that we're going to get a better result. It just defies logic. And that's why I got into this race. The biggest thing I think we have to have in American politics today is we have to have champions for liberty. It's not a prerequisite to have political experience. It's not a prerequisite to be a business owner. It's not a prerequisite to be a political organizer. Can you be a champion for liberty to the American people? I think that 60% of the nation knows that something is very, very wrong. Most of them cannot articulate what's actually going wrong in American society today. And most voters are just looking for somebody to just stand up, to speak truth to power, and to just make the real arguments, not only from a policy perspective, but from a liberty perspective here in America. And I'm of the opinion that if you expect a politician to do that, then you'll be waiting a very, very long time. And really, the only people who can make those kind of arguments are citizens who really just want to live their own personal lives, but realize that they simply cannot if they want America to continue.
Well, I guess you definitely know the definition between a politician and a statesman then. We talk about that all the time here on American Statesman, and you just said it. A politician's never going to do this. A politician is out there working for the next election. They'll do whatever it takes to get reelected. The statesman is working for the next generation, and they're there to get the job done. And you are committed to being a statesman.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, in my campaign, one of the things that I talk about often is preserving America for the next 100 years. It's actually, you know, the story behind where I got that is actually pretty interesting. I was in Marco Island, and I was at a meeting for a gentleman who's running for the United States Senate, who nobody ever talks about, but I actually think is probably a very good candidate, and that's Ron McNeil. Out of DeLand, Florida. And he talked about having a permanence of conditions for 200 years if you wanted to have the American economy hum along. And I knew what he was saying, and I liked it, and I went to him. I was like, you know, Ron, I like that, but I'm going to change it. I just want to say preserving America for the next 100. And he said, you know, go right ahead, use it. And that's really the first way you know you're dealing with somebody of quality, because they understand that if you use an idea that I have, that's only to the betterment of all of us. You know, I also think that, you know, when you look at a politician or anybody running for office, nobody is creating new solutions that have never been heard of before. All we're doing is looking at human experience, looking at different ideas that have come up in time, throughout time, maybe making some slight adjustments for today. But for the most part, there's no new ideas out there. All these ideas are on the table. They've been on the table. The difference is, are you going to have leaders who are going to stand up and actually try to promote them and to present them to the American people so they can choose what exactly they want of American society?
Well, and, you know, I have met Ron McNeil, and, yes, I was impressed. And we have actually sent an invitation for him to come on the show, so we're still working on those details. So I hope he will come on. And you're right, you don't hear too much about him. You hear about, you know, the Connie Mack and whoever else out there. Those who have already been there and done some of their own, whatever they want to call what they did. We won't go down that road right now. But the other thing is, now, as a GO candidate, we talked a little bit about what the GO process is and how you were selected from citizens of your congressional district. And there were different questions. You were vetted. And I don't know if we want to get into too much of the detail of the vetting process, but I did want you to kind of share what it was like to be vetted for a GO candidate, what you like about the process. To me, the key is it's actually the people of your district who picked you versus the establishment at any political party or whatever else. But go ahead and tell us a little bit about the GO process and what you thought about it.
Well, you know, the GO process is probably one of the most rigorous things I've ever done, because you are literally basically competing on your ideas with everybody at the table. You know, for those who don't know what the GO process actually is, imagine sitting at a table with 6 to 10 people of which you don't know any of them, and having to basically sell yourself as to why you should be the next congressman for your district. I mean, that's really what you're trying to do. You're dealing with people you don't really know, you've probably met on occasion, or if you know them at all, and you're going through the same questions, and you have to display more than just a right answer. You have to display a mindset and a thoughtful approach to your answers and to why you arrive at the thinking you have behind that question. I mean, that's really the one thing I think all voters are really looking for. It's not whether you're for something or against something. It's how did you process your answer? Like, what have you relied on to come to this point? How do you think through these issues? Because that's going to tell me how you're going to operate in Washington. Just being able to sit in front of a bunch of people and they ask you a question and you give a 30 second answer doesn't really tell me how you think. And I think the GO process really tells you how somebody thinks, how they process information, and really what they would do if they were in that position. The second thing the GO process really does is it informs the other people at the table. You know, throughout the whole process, there were things I was learning that I did not know. And I think, you know, in order to be a quality representative, you have to understand what you don't know. Really, to be a quality anything in life, you have to know, understand what you don't know. And so you're sitting around with people who are just as concerned about this, about our society, as you are. And to be picked as the GO candidate from all those people is probably one of the most humbling things I've really ever been a part of. You know, the final round were 12 people who were, their ideas were excellent. They knew the issues very well. They knew how to articulate them. They had reasons and history behind their answers. And to be picked from amongst that 12 to be, you know, the go representative, if you will, to be to be picked by your peers, by people in your community, it was a tremendous honor.
Well, and the other part too with go, just so those who aren't familiar with the process, obviously it's whoever participates in the district. So you, sometimes you have more people involved than others, and you go through a series of vetting processes. It's not all just done in one night. So there's a commitment by the people of the district to pick somebody, but then there's also the commitment of whoever ends up being the go candidate. Just for example, just so people understand when it comes to the questions, there's a series of questions you go through. And there's no right or wrong answer. It's strictly what you believe. Like a question could be, would you vote for or against the balanced budget amendment?
Yeah.
And then, so, yeah. And everybody checks off what they would do, and then after you check off what your position would be, then you go around and you explain why you would believe one way or the other. And then the other part, and this is, I definitely want to get your take on this, because I've actually had some people act like they were concerned, or people who are running for office who wouldn't participate in this, and I thought it said a lot, spoke volumes for them, when, you know, part of the GO process is, one, you would support term limits, and two, you will limit yourself to two terms, I think it is, and that kind of thing. And there's a lot of, or I shouldn't say a lot, I've had several candidates who expressed, well, you know, I can't be a GO candidate because I'm not going to say that I'll be limited to two terms or something like that. But you actually make a contract with the people, and that you will hold to how you voted on issues too. Isn't that part of the process as well?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you're basically displaying to the people at the table that, you know, my views and my opinions on these issues will remain in stone and will remain in place. I mean, and that's really what, when we go through this political process, to those of us who are really engaged in it and get frustrated by it, that's what we basically want. You know, if you're going to say it now, just do that, because that's what I'm voting for. And that's what the GO process does. It basically gives you a marker with the people in your district to be like, to basically say, this is who I am, this is how I think, this is what I intend to do. And if I don't follow through, then it becomes your responsibility to hold me accountable. And I think with a lot of the things you talked about, term limits, I think term limits are very, very important, but term limits go both ways. You know, if we just take a look at the Florida House right now, the biggest problem in the Florida House is that the staffers are the ones that know everything, because in a weird way, because of term limits. And so what you have is, we have a political system in the state of Florida where guys are just basically biding their time, not challenging the incumbents, but they're just biding their time until it's their turn, you know, instead of just saying, you know what, I think I'm better than this candidate, so I'm going to run against them. You know, I mean, I would vote for term limits in the United States Congress, there's no doubt about that, but I am a huge believer that the best term limit is the ballot box, because it's a requirement of the citizen to actually take control of their politics. You know, when I'm on the campaign trail, you know, all of my opponents, we all say the greatest things. You know, everybody says that we're for this and we're going to balance the budget and we're going to cut spending and we're going to do all these wonderful things. But the truth of the matter is that if you want to really hold a politician accountable, if you want them to do these things, it's a requirement that the people are engaged with their politics. And that's how you really have the best government.
And, you know, I don't totally disagree with that, because I know in the past we've talked about term limits, but everybody say, hey, there's term limits every 2 to 4 years when you go vote. You have the option to do the term limits. And if our complaint, the FBI complaint, and I know you're a little bit familiar with it, but we might talk about it a little bit later, but the FBI complaint that Charlie and I have filed is also that we can truly have term limits at the ballot box. The way the system has been, the election process has been so corrupted today, there is no such thing as term limits, regardless of who you vote for, because the parties have locked up the process so much that they keep whoever they want in there. And that's why some people are allowed to stay in there 30 and 40 years. I mean,
yes.
The whole process even is has gone totally out of control on that level. Well, there's one other thing that I wanted to ask, and then I'm going to get Charlie in here, and we'll start going through the real questions now, and of course, you're welcome to share any other opinions on things you're thinking about right now. But I always like to know, who is your favorite president and why?
You know, I honestly, I know the easy pick for Republicans is Reagan, but I actually am a fan of Calvin Coolidge. You know, I think, you know, if you look back at Calvin Coolidge, first of all, the biggest thing I admired about him was that he was a president with restraint. you know, he could have acted and he could have done a lot of things. He could have wielded the power of the federal government at that point in American history, but he did not. He chose not to. You know, one of the funny things that I think, you know, if you look back at some of his history, you know, they'll say that, well, when he was a governor, he did wield some power and some authority. Well, I think that Calvin Coolidge really understood what federalism was all about, and he actually decided to use the legislative power he was granted as a governor when he was in the state legislature. But when he became vice president and president, he understood that it was not his role to enforce his will on the American people and the states. It was his job basically to make sure that stability reigned so that people can make of themselves what they will. The other big thing I really like about Calvin Coolidge, he term limited himself. He could have run for re-election. I mean, it was 1928. The great crash, the stock market crash hadn't happened yet. He could have run for re-election, probably would have won very, very easily. But he said, listen, I've been here too long as is. I'm just going to go home. And that's what he did. So right now I think that's probably my most favorite president right now. And now, of course, I could go with Abraham Lincoln and all of the popular answers. But I think in today's society, what we really need are politicians who can have some political restraint. I think that's going to be key for us if we're going to reverse course.
And isn't that so refreshing to know that in the past, it truly was about doing the right thing. It was about public service. It was about duty, honor, and country. Not today, the career politician things that we have. So it's like a cancer. The politician, I truly do believe, is a cancer on this whole country and on this whole process. And because, you know, George Washington was the same thing. George Washington could have been king. He could have stayed there forever. And it shows the difference of the integrity of the person who would not be king, who didn't believe because they believe in true freedom and liberty, kind of thing. So that's very encouraging to hear. I love your answer there. We do have we're going to go to Keith in a minute too, but I want to go ahead and let Charlie have a chance. Charlie, do you have any questions? We have our list of questions for Byron, but is there anything you wanted to ask him, or do you want to start going down the list?
Well, no, I've got a question because you brought up answering all of the questions for the goal process.
Mm-hmm.
And also you had to sign something that states this is how you would vote, and you're not going to change it because you don't want to get, go against what you said you're going to do.
Yeah.
Now, what if all of a sudden you got a bunch of letters from citizens, and they say, we don't like this thing. We don't like your stand on this. What are you intending to do? Because now you're getting pressure from, let's say, special interests, but also citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Then
explain
your situation when it is something where you said, yes, I'm going to vote on this, but now all of a sudden people are saying is, we don't like that.
Okay. I mean, you know, the first thing is, one is, I think you have to really explain the issue. You know, I think the biggest problem we have in our politics today is that our politicians don't take the time to actually explain the issue at hand, and also to help to educate some of the electorate to say, hey, listen, I understand why you feel that way, but here's some of the other facts that are not being portrayed to you in the news media. Here's some of the other things that are happening, and this is why my stance is as it is on this, and that's why my stance has been on, let's just talk about a balanced budget amendment, or actually let's go even further, let's talk about spending caps and the end of baseline budgeting. You know, here's the reason why I stand against baseline budgeting. You know, there will be remarks from my opponents in Washington or whatever the case might be who will say, well, if you don't have automatic spending increases, it doesn't allow for the growth of the food stamp program, and you see that as a detriment to you. But the truth of the matter is, if we allow the food stamp program or any other program to continue to increase in size, we're not going to have the ability to actually control our debt and deficits. I'm just using this as an example. But I think that's the first step, is you have to actually go get into the dialogue and the discourse with your constituency, you know, and that's what you have to do. You know, the second thing is, are you going to uphold the Constitution? Because if your constituency wants you to do something that's unconstitutional, well, then that's the time where you, as a leader, as an elected official, you have to abide by the United States Constitution. Your job is restraint. Your job is not to just be a populist all the time. Sometimes you have to do things that uphold the Constitution and uphold political restraint. And there are times where our citizens clamor for things when that's not in the best interest of the nation over the long term. It doesn't respect the people that we'll never see, which is one of the things I also talk about a lot. It's not so much that you have to represent your district and your constituency. You do. But you also have to make sure you're representing the interest of those yet to be born into your constituency. Because that goes back to the preamble in the Constitution of our posterity. You know, so there is a relationship there that you have to protect. So that's the first step is education. The second step is, you know, you have to weigh what the district wants versus the constitutionality of it.
Okay, one other question. Okay, yes. Good. That's very good. Now, one other question. When you're there and you're doing these things and you're starting to get pressure from the special interests and everything else, and all of a sudden you see something that is really totally in violation, are you going to be an honorable Rat Fink against your peers who are definitely violating the Constitution? And let's say that you voted no and they voted yes, and you know that it is a violation. Are you going to do something about it, or are you going to be like the status quo going and just say, well, they passed it, so we'll just go on to the next issue?
No, I think you got to take every opportunity to educate the electorate. I really do. I think the education of our voters about what individual liberty really means, about what individual sovereignty really means, about what federalism really means, is going to be crucial if we're going to preserve this nation. I mean, if I'm just going to go along to get along, I might as well just stay home.
Yeah, so then if all of your peers in Washington vote for something that you know is definitely a violation of, say, the Constitution or the rights of the people, and maybe just the laws, or they're trying to pass a law that would violate the rights of the people, then you are going to be, or you're going to at least let your constituents know why you voted against it and what you think they should do about it to get it corrected, right?
Absolutely. You know, yeah. to take that a step further, the other thing I think this is going to be necessary from our Congress people and our senators going forward is they have to move to get like-minded people elected. I think Jim DeMint's already started the ball rolling with that, you know, starting to look out and say, you know what, it's not enough just to me to be a senator and try to stop things in Washington. I got to go out there and try to get more guys in here who think like me. And I think that's the second step of to your question. If you see a bunch of guys who are your peers in the House of Representatives doing things that are going to be to the detriment of our society and to the Constitution, part of your duty is not only just in your constituency, but in other constituencies around the nation, and making sure that we get like-minded people in here. Because the purpose, you know, I was in a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and I really said, you know, the talk is we got to have people who are business-minded. And I slightly disagree with that. We have to have people who are trustee-minded. You know, you're a trustee. You're not simply a CEO. You're not simply a middle manager, if you will. You are a trustee, and the beneficiary is the American people. And so we have to have leaders who are trustee-minded in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just talking about fiduciary responsibility before you came on, and that falls almost right into it, is that you have a fiduciary responsibility to your constituents and to the American people as a whole. And therefore,
right.
Yeah, therefore, there's a lot of them now that violate that fiduciary responsibility, and we need people in there who are not going to be afraid to actually say something that, you know, you're in violation of a fiduciary responsibility to the people, so that they will be also informed as to the mistakes they're making.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and actually, and on that same line, because, you know, the whole thing about the Constitution, which, you know, we get into quite a bit here on American States on Blog Talk Radio, is, and I mean, I'm talking or saying this because of having listened to the various candidates, including the presidential ones. I mean, I remember listening to these debates, and almost every one of these Republican candidates supported the Patriot Act and supported NDAA, and they both violate the Constitution. And the question, and so I've started asking candidates, well, what part of the Constitution are you planning on following? Because it seems like everybody kind of picks and chooses what they feel like. So when it comes to issues like NDAA and the Patriot Act that are so grossly, and of course Obamacare, and I know you're going to want to tell us what you think on Obamacare here, but when it's so obvious that these things violate our core rights, our right to own property and these kind of things, yet nobody seems to stand up and fight for us. And these are presidential candidates who said, well, we don't care about the Constitution. We care more about the Patriot Act and the NDAA, even though they stomp all over your rights. So I ask the question, what part of the Constitution are you going to govern by? What are you going to do when you're faced with these challenges? Because the NDAA, while it was good to authorize the military appropriations kind of thing, Defense Appropriations Act is what it was, but at the same time, they slipped these little things in there that totally go against the Constitution, giving the right to detain a citizen indefinitely without cause. What would you do in that situation?
Well, the first thing you do is you try to work to get that piece of language out of the bill, or you can't vote for the bill. And listen, I believe that we need to have a strong military. I do. But we cannot have a strong military to the detriment of the liberty of the American people, because the purpose of our military is to protect the liberty of the people, not to infringe upon it. And so that's the key thing. You know, one thing on the NDAA, and I started talking about this, especially down in my district, you know, the person we have to thank for that language being in that defense authorization bill is John McCain. He's the one who put that in there, who slipped that in at the last minute. That's John McCain's handiwork. But let's go back to, you said it best about how would you govern under the Constitution. Well, primarily, of course, Article 1, since I'm running for Congress going into the legislative branch. But you have to govern under the framework and the foundation of the entire Constitution. I don't subscribe to the theory that it's a living and breathing document. There's no such thing as a living and breathing foundation. Anytime you have a foundation that's living and breathing, you have to condemn the entire building because you can't trust it. Because it doesn't allow you to move office furniture in or set up your bedroom or to watch TV in the living room or to cook in the kitchen. You cannot live in a structure that has a shaky or a living and breathing foundation. And so when it comes to governing, I think you have to have adherence to the Constitution as a fixed document that stands the test of time. So that's really how I view that. Specifically about the NDAA, I think it's one of the great disasters, giving unilateral power to the president. And it really doesn't have anything to do with Barack Obama. It could be George W. Bush. It could be Calvin Coolidge, for all I care. No president should have that level of authority to detain American citizens. You know, that's one of the things, quite frankly, that our framers detested about King George. And really, through a lot of the tyranny of the monarchy, through the time the colonies were colonies, you know, so this is a very, very weird path that we're on, but actually it's a predictable path. You know, the common trend of governments is towards tyranny. It really is, because a government will always increase in size and scope because most men will choose to use a government for their own purposes one way or the other. I mean, Frederick Bastiat talked about that incessantly because he saw it happen in the French government, which led to the French Revolution. And so, you know, when it comes to governing under the Constitution, I think that you have to abide by the entire document. I don't think you can pick out phrases willy-nilly to suit your political interests. I think that's one of the things that we absolutely detest from the left, and it's something that, you know, that Republicans have done on their side of the aisle as well. You have to use the whole document.
Well, I totally agree, and I'm telling you, I love hearing you say all this. I know that Keith is out there, so I'm going to go ahead and let Keith get in here and see if he wanted to ask you any specific questions. Hey, Keith, you still there?
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. The first one is, you know, having traveled the state for the last, seems like 2 years, there's a huge amount of apathy out there. And it boils down, in many respects, to the voters just have a tremendous lack of trust in their government. We've just gone through, in 2010, a biggest shift in my lifetime, where we elected 63, a total of 85 new freshman congressmen, but 63 of them were red versus blue. And already we see the majority of those folks siding with the establishment. So Byron, is a new, when you're elected as a new congressman, why should we trust you, and what do you see as the role of a freshman congressman?
Well, I'll take the second one first. The role of a freshman congressman, first of all, I think, is to do no harm. It's to not do any additional harm that has been done by, you know, my predecessors. plural, no matter who they are in the United States House of Representatives. Your job really is to make sure that when bills come to the floor for your vote, that you're voting according to, one, to the Constitution, two, to what you laid out in front of your constituency when you got elected in the first place. The second thing I think as a congressman, this really transcends being a freshman, is you can't just simply be content with being in Washington and just trying to meander through committees and things of that nature. Of course, there's bills you're going to want to propose. There's agenda items that you're going to want to have. I have my own. But you also have to use that platform to energize the public. You know, I think you said it best. So many people are apathetic, and they're apathetic because they constantly see the same old happening in politics. You know, in this race, and really in all races, the first question they ask anybody who decides to run for a high office, they ask you, how much money do you have? They don't ask you what your ideas are. They don't ask you how smart you are. They don't ask you what have you done in your life, you know, what kind of a foundation that you have as a person. They ask, how much money do you have? Because the insiders, the professional politicians, they know that the citizens will not pay attention. They know that most campaigns are simply marketing campaigns and not political campaigns. And they know that most people won't actually work for a candidate. They might pick up and do a couple phone calls. They might knock on three doors, but that's about it. But money will do the work for you. And so that's how we've gotten to this point in our politics, because no longer is the politician looking at the people. They're looking at their campaign accounts to make sure that they have enough money to be a quote-unquote viable candidate. And I think, you know, in terms of how you can trust me as a representative, the first thing is, you know, we're out of time. I have a young family. You know, I grew up poor. I grew up from an inner city, and I know that if we don't get this thing back on track quickly, if we don't really start to stabilize the American government, it's going to be the poor in all societies who are going to suffer. And, you know, I've worked with youth in my church for 9 years. I've sacrificed my own personal time even before I ever thought of having any political ambitions. And I've sacrificed my personal time for kids in my church because I want them to have the best life possible. And I take that same kind of thought process, that same kind of framework to Washington. You know, in my opinion, they've had it their way. They've had their time in the sun. They've made bills, and they've cut sausage, and they've compromised, and they've worked across the aisle, and they've done all these things to the detriment of the American people. So obviously that's not the right course.
Okay. I think that's great. Let me move to a kind of a different topic. If you look at our economy, you know, both sides of the equation are clamoring for the government's role to create jobs. And I know you're a proponent of the fair tax. Could you give us your insight as to what the role of government is in creating jobs, if you believe in that, and how do you see the fair tax enabling that whole arena?
Well, the government has no role in creating jobs because the government has no role in creating wealth. The government doesn't create anything. It only taxes and destroys. Its real purpose is to maintain stability. You know, I graduated college in 2002, just after 9/11. Before 9/11, the job market in America was great for a kid coming out of college with a degree in finance. You could have any job you wanted. But after 9/11, the job market dried up. For no other reason, because the veneer of security, of stability, was gone from the United States of America. And so when that happened, the jobs dried up. So the purpose, if you want to have job formation in America, American government's role is to provide stability, in all phases of economics, so that our job creators can do what they do best and hire people. Now, how the fair tax works into that is that I think that what you have to do in today's world, if you want to be the haven of job creation and business creation, if you want to be the haven of manufacturing, you have to understand and really start to operate under the truth that corporations don't pay taxes anyway. that all taxes are passed on to the end consumer, and the fair tax recognizes that. I'm a huge supporter of the fair tax. I will be a co-sponsor for it in the House. But more than that, I'm going to champion the fair tax. I'm actually going to promote it across the nation and use whatever platform is afforded to me to help bring that into law. You know, the fair tax does one very important thing to put job creation to the side for a moment. It restores the proper relationship between the federal government and the American people. You know, there's a reason that Woodrow Wilson started with taxation when he fundamentally transformed America, because Woodrow Wilson was the first to do that, to fundamentally transform America. There's a reason he started with taxation, with the 16th Amendment. And I think if you want to have robust job growth, but also if you want to solve this conundrum, this riddle of not having engaged citizens, you have to change taxation and make the federal government's receiving of tax revenue. We have to put them on the burden of being subjects to us the people, not being a sovereign when it comes to tax collection. They have to become a subject once again, and we the people have to become sovereign if we want to have a tax system that will actually create jobs and will actually control government. I think the fair tax does both of those things. It will allow capital to flow to these shores freely, because you're telling businesses around the world, hey, guess what, we're not going to tax you. If you tell a business, I'm not going to tax you, where do you think they're going to go with their money? They're going to go to the place where they feel it's easiest to make money, not because they're greedy and they're selfish, but because a business owner, like anybody else, seeks their own interests. That's what we all do. And so American economic policy needs to mirror that basic understanding of human nature, that people seek their own interests. And the fair tax is the primary way we can do that.
Okay. Well, Keith, did you have anything else? You want to just kind of stay online and come in as you need?
Well, let me ask one last question, and then I'll shut up.
Okay.
We're all operating under the hope. Many of us are operating under the hope that the Obama health care plan gets overturned in some fashion by the court.
Yes.
So what if they do? What's your view of what happens next?
Well, then you have to have real health care reform. You know, the president's plan is a disaster. Like, I hope the Supreme Court overturns the entire thing. Real quick before I move on what happens next, if the individual mandate falls but the rest of the bill remains, it's going to be an even bigger problem to private insurance and to the cost of care in America, because the individual mandate was the one thing in that bill which actually helped to stave off the inevitable that private insurance would go by the wayside. If you go to a system where you're not mandated, you're not coerced to buy an insurance policy, but the insurance companies have to cover you and there's no lifetime cap, private insurance is going to go away much faster without the individual mandate. So it is my hope that the entire law goes away. But let's operate under the assumption that it's all gone and we're back to square one with health care. You have to have real reform, which changes the delivery system for health insurance in America. Right now we deliver health insurance on a model that we created in World War II. You know, we have businesses provide insurance to their employees. Well, the reason why the cost of care continues to increase is because the employees, because the user of health care, are not concerned with the cost of health care because they don't pay the insurance premiums. The business owners do. And so you have to look at it in the same vein, if you will, that we look at consumer electronics. If you have an iPod or if you have a cell phone or an iPhone, the reason why those things continue to get better with time, but the cost of the product remains relatively stable and you continue to get a better product, is because you are using your own money to shop for the best possible product at the lowest possible price. That's why the cost of consumer electronics actually goes down over time. And if you want to control the cost of healthcare, you have to apply the same economic principle. You have to have people buy their own insurance with their own money and allow them to look for the best possible insurance policy at the lowest possible price. I think you get rid of the tax deductibility that businesses have. You give that to consumers, and if we have the fair tax, then that won't be a problem. The second thing you do is you get rid of the state mandates on health insurance, and you allow people to buy health insurance across state lines. that will open up the market tremendously because you have people in Florida actually buying health insurance from Idaho, New Mexico, or wherever they want to, looking for the best product at the lowest possible price. I think those two things would revolutionize the health insurance market. I know the other thing that comes up is tort reform. I'm back and forth on whether tort reform is a federal issue or a state issue. I think the Cato Institute makes a compelling argument that tort law is actually a state issue because you're basically dealing with a doctor operating in a state actually performing harm to a patient who lives in that same state. But I think tort reform, you can put that on the side for a moment, is the delivery system that has been the problem for health insurance in America. And that's what we need to be fixed. That's what needs to be fixed.
Well, you know, and I'll only follow up one thing on the insurance. I think it's very interesting the way the federal government tries to use the Commerce Act, the Commerce Clause, for all these different things that they, for health care specifically, Obamacare. When, to me, if you were going to use the Commerce Clause for anything, the Commerce Act, it truly would be that you should be able to sell insurance in different states. That
yes.
would seem to be more appropriate use of the Commerce Act, but they don't want to use it for that. They want to use it for all this other nonsense. So I always found that kind of interesting. Because,
well, exactly.
Go ahead.
Well, the reason they choose to the reason Obamacare uses the Commerce Clause the way it does is because it empowers Washington. It makes perfect sense to me, not perfect sense from an economic standpoint, but perfect sense if you understand the natural bent of government and really the natural bent of the utopian mindset, of the collectivist mindset. In the president's view, it is best that these things are handled through the federal government because then he becomes the arbiter of this fairness that he loves to talk about so much. The truth is, no man can be the arbiter of fairness because that person who becomes that arbiter, if you will, they're seeking their own interests too. You know, and that's the other thing we got to realize. I mean, Milton Friedman said it best when he was on Donahue's show a long time ago. He said it best. This clip's all over YouTube. I'm quite sure many people have seen it. He basically said, you think that politicians don't run on greed? They don't appoint political appointees because of their excellence in their private lives. They appoint it because there's some political or economic interest in that person being on their team. So this whole thing about greed and about selfishness is really silly. We have to understand that people will always seek their own interests. Everybody does it, and there's nothing wrong with that. See, now this is the argument, this moral argument that I'm making right now, this is the kind of arguments we need to be hearing from. I guess it's Mitt Romney now. This is the kind of arguments we have to hear from our presidential candidates. These are the kind of arguments we need to hear from our senatorial candidates. These are the kind of arguments we have to hear from our congressional candidates because these are the things that the American people have to know and have to understand if we're going to get an engaged electorate.
Well, we won't get into the Romney thing unless we have extra time at the end because I'm still one of those that believes that the we could have a broker convention in Tampa. But we'll get to that later if we have time. There was a question in the chat room, and first off, I wanted to ask David. He mentioned he had to drop off, but he's going to finish listening to the show later. He wanted to tell Keith his questions were great. And then, two, he had a question out there. Why should the voters in your district choose you over the other candidate? Did the GOAT leader tell you how to vote on your ballot? And when you are elected, will your votes be for sale? Good question.
What was the second question?
Second question, did the GO leaders tell you how to vote on your ballot? I thought that was kind of a strange question, but okay.
Okay, well, I'll go in reverse order. Number one, with reference to my vote being for sale, the answer is no, it won't be for sale. My vote's going to be to preserve America. And so if that's your position, if that's what you want to do as a private citizen, then we will always be in agreement. The second thing about did the GO leader tell me how to vote? No, because you can't tell anybody how to vote in the GO process because the answers to the sheet honestly don't really matter much. What matters is your interaction with the people at the table. That's really how you begin to decipher who you could see as being a political leader, a political statesman, if you will, and who you would not want to see in that position. So the GO leader did not tell me how to answer, but really however they think I should answer doesn't really matter, because if I can't sell that answer, if I can't explain that answer to the people at my table with conviction, they're going to see right through me anyway. The third thing is, the original question, I forgot the original question. What was that one again?
Why should the voters in your district choose you over the other candidate?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think two things in Washington. Number one, you have to have an understanding and the ability to craft quality solutions for the problems that we face. I think that's the primary, I think that's the job of a congressman. I think that's the historical job for a congressman. But in today's politics where we are, you also have to be able to convince and persuade the average voter with reason and with history. And in this congressional race in my district, I am the best candidate at being able to persuade the average voter with reason and with experience. Case in point, we now have five members of our campaign who are lifelong Democrats, who have changed their registration to Republican, to become a Republican to vote for me in the primary. These are people who are active workers on my campaign now. I never knew them before I got into politics. These are people who came to an event that we held or came to a meet and greet. They listen to me speak and make my arguments about what we need to do with America. They listen to me answer questions, and they were just like, this is the guy. I'm changing my registration to vote for him. This is what we have to do. You know, this we have to be able to persuade the average voter. You know, one of the things that I think has really helped me to be able to do that is, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I'm 33 years old. I'm a black man. You know, I registered as a Democrat when I was 18 years old. I changed my registration to a Republican in 2010. And the only reason why I changed my registration in 2010 is because I was tired of not being able to vote in the Republican primary, because in my view, that's where the action is anyway, in the state of Florida. But also, I became a Republican because the Republican Party's views and policies are more in line with my views and policies. And so I became a Republican for that reason. But that process from being a young Democrat from Brooklyn to being a conservative Republican today, that was a process of a lot of economic analysis, of political analysis and reading, of political philosophy and reading, and actually thinking through these issues, debating them with family members and friends during the 2008 elections, trying to convince family of mine and friends of mine not to vote for Barack Obama. And through that whole process, that really helped to develop the mindset I have now. So I'm a convert, if you will. I really converted myself, or I guess you could say political philosophy and actual economic arguments converted me. And now, since I had to go through that process, I have the ability to do that to other voters. And if the Republican Party is going to be successful in elections, we have to have people who can make the moral argument as to why we have to do what we have to do from a policy perspective. I do that better than any other candidate in this race. And that's really what we need in terms of leadership.
Well, and I'll tell you, on that same note, as a former Republican, I'm now a no-party affiliate. I'm going the way of George Washington. And I do believe what George Washington said, the parties will divide us and destroy us as a united people. The thing is, you know, it sounds like, and everything I'm hearing from you, is you are the core fundamental of what the Republican Party is supposed to stand for. But to me, what I see in the Republican Party so much across the board is just a bunch of mush. It means nothing. They can't even keep a straight face, I think, on some of the stuff they say. I've gotten so disgusted with party politics in general. That's why, of course, I like that go bumper sticker with Republican, Democrat, and Fed Up. I'm under the Fed Up column. So I can appreciate that your core convictions are aligned with what the Republican Party is supposed to be, but today's Republican Party just doesn't seem to hold up. And I have been a proponent myself because of what has become of the Republican Party as I see it. To me, it needs to be abolished. If you can get it back, you know, Ronald Reagan saved it once, but I don't think you're going to be able to save the Republican Party as a whole. But, you know, I can appreciate that you are in that party for that reason. I also don't support closed primaries. Go ahead.
No, I mean, well, I understand your point. I really do, because I know several people down here who share that same view. My view of it is, you know, the country – I mean, how long does the country really have? In my view, it's probably 15 to 20 years. And then if that's the case, what is it going to take to make sure that eventuality doesn't come to fruition? You know, if the federal government begins to implode under its own weight, the people who are truly going to suffer are the poor and middle-income Americans in our major cities. They're going to be the ones who are going to suffer. So when I look at it, I look at it strategically. What is the best, what's the quickest way, what is the best course of action to staving off something that will be a huge detriment to the American people in the future? And I view it as you have to begin to take over the Republican Party. I don't say that it's going to be easy at all. Listen, I'm in a primary battle down here. You know, early on in this race when I got in, you know, everybody said, oh, yeah, he's cute, that's whatever. You know, he's not viable. But through my ideas, through my passion for him, through the way I explain it, we've developed some very, very strong traction in this race, and we continue to do so. But I'm of the mindset today that the only way we're actually going to be able to preserve America is to actually take over and change the Republican Party from within and hold it. See, that's the second part, and hold it. And I think that's where groups like, you know, the Tea Party movement and various other groups come into play. Because you can't, it's not so much that you send one guy, like you send Reagan in to adjust the nature of the party for eight years. That's not enough. We have to have multiple people throughout the framework of the Republican Party to hold the line. And that's my focus and the way I think about it.
Well, Ryan. And, you know, again, I agree. I agree in philosophy and theory of what you're saying. I can support it. I can only tell you that both Charlie and I in the past have been on the Republican Executive Committee here in Orange County. It was a big. There was so much corruption in the Republican Party here in Florida that, and I ran for public office when I was a Republican. So I've seen a little bit more than what I particularly care to. So my own opinion of the Republican Party and whether it can be revived is probably just a little bit different. But that's not. We won't get into too much detail. Charlie, were you going to say something?
Yeah. It'd be nice to have Brian mention his name and his website and his email address so people can get in touch with him.
Oh, sure. Well, again, my name's Byron Donalds. My website is my name. It's ByronDonalds.com, BYRONDONALDS.com. Also, you can email me at Byron@ByronDonalds.com. We try to keep it pretty straightforward. One of the things on my website that I think a lot of the listeners will really like to see is I wrote a vision for America's future. It's about a 6-page document on what I feel is going to be the vision that is that's going to be necessary to preserve America's future for the next 100 years. And I wrote that out in our campaign. You know, I've looked at other campaign websites. You do your homework when you're a candidate. You look at your opponents. You look at other races to see if there's anything that's working, things that are not working. And I haven't seen any candidate in any race in America that has actually sat down and wrote out a vision statement for what he wants to do or what she wants to accomplish in American government today. And that's something that we wrote for our campaign. I'm actually very proud of it, and I would recommend to your listeners that they take the time to read it.
Well, I will apologize, but I did not read that piece. I did go up and I was looking at your stance on some of the issues and the fair tax and Obamacare and those types of things, but I have to admit I did not read that. So I will go out there and take a look at it. I want to make sure that we get one other question it's a two-part question. They're very much related, and then we'll go back to Charlie to see what else he's got. When I was talking about the Patriot Act and NDAA, I wanted to also talk about Agenda 21 and the United Nations crap of the sustainable development, how they are trying to make it one world order, one world government, and how protecting our property rights. Because right now we've got the EPA and the federal government literally taking over people's farms and property. And, you know, Adams and Washington were both very adamant in saying, if you don't have the right to own property, you have no liberty. So let me get to those two questions to you, and then we will go to Charlie and let him ask some questions for you.
All right, well, real quick, when it comes to Agenda 21 and ICLEI and that whole thing, I think it's an absolute disaster. It makes no sense at all where we are giving up our sovereignty to some international body with respect to zoning parameters and to the way that we build structures here in America. It will only serve to hurt our people, and it only serve really to it does not help us with economic growth, because there's just another layer of bureaucratic waste that you have to go through in the different counties across America. I know there's a movement out there now where the different counties are basically saying, no, we're not signing on to it, or we're getting out from underneath it. And I think that definitely has to happen. With respect to no, not NDAA, and that was Agenda 21. What was the other one?
Property rights. The fact that we've got an EPA and a federal government that has just gone overboard, taking away the people's rights to own property, and some of this even ties into, you know, we talk about sovereign, that the U.S. government is a corporation and a state is a corporation, and you're a corporate citizen versus a sovereign citizen, and these different pieces. But the whole thing is, right now, the truth is, we don't have the right to own property, and that was such a big deal. That's one of the main things of our founding.
It is. Listen, the EPA needs to be severely curtailed, in my opinion. I think, you know, right now they're doing a myriad of things. Number one, you're talking about property with farms. That's a huge issue that they're doing right now, trying to use the Clean Air Act and a Supreme Court opinion to basically allow them to rewrite environmental policy as they see fit. Or I guess as Lisa Jackson sees fit, is absolutely ridiculous. And that needs to stop immediately. The other thing with respect to the EPA that's happening right now, and I'm not sure if your listeners are aware, if you're aware, the EPA just rewrote the coal standards. They basically are implementing cap and trade without the trade. They're just capping. And they've actually just rewrote the emission standards on coal, so much so that they're going to have to take down some of the coal production because the coal power plants can't meet these new standards. So electricity rates are going to go up, just like how President Obama said they would before the election under his plan. And so that's something that the EPA is doing as well. And all these things are a complete disaster. I was also reading today, this is more deals with the Interior and the Department of Energy, that the leases to drill in the Gulf of Mexico, they've completely slowed down the leasing process. So even though the government owns these lands, they are not doing anything that a normal landowner would do. They're trying to inhibit and stop the production of oil and gasoline in the Gulf of oil in the Gulf of Mexico. So there's a whole lot of things with respect to property rights that we have to get back to basics on. You know, I think it's especially with the EPA and the Department of Energy, it directly affects the ability of this nation to be energy independent. You know, we hear all this talk of wind and solar, and those things may be nice, and they might do well 20 or 30 years from now, but they cannot operate today because they don't operate on an economic scale that makes it a cheap alternative to the American people. And we cannot have the president using the executive branch to change energy policy, which is really what he's trying to do, change energy policy through the EPA and through the Department of Energy.
Okay, and Charlie, before we go to you, we do have a caller who has a question here. So I'm going to go to the caller real quick. Caller, the last four digits are 6703. Caller, can I get your name, please?
Yeah, this is Richard.
Hey, Richard. You have a question?
Good evening. You have a tremendous guest tonight, extremely knowledgeable. And one thing that certainly comes out is you can hear a good orator, and you can hear a good orator that's smooth and puts in all kinds of syrup into their exposition or their rhetoric. This man's sincerity stands out with every word that he emits, and I certainly hope that you'll think about bringing him on again.
Oh, most definitely. Yeah, assuming that Byron will join us. But, yeah, right now this has been excellent. Now, we still got another 30 minutes.
Let me voice my opinion on one more thing, if I may, please. When we join the service or as elected officials, we take an oath to the Constitution. And our oath to the Constitution does not expire. It's for our lifetime, for the time of our life here on this planet, in the United States, as citizens. And I hope there's perhaps some people listening tonight that are picking up on that and understanding that we, the people, have so much responsibility, have power and responsibility. And you're doing a tremendous job. Really appreciate it. I got some emails out for you today, and I'll continue to do so. Thank you, Richard. You betcha. Take care.
Okay. Well, thank you, Richard. Okay, we'll go ahead and we'll mute his mic there. Unless he decides he wants to talk again, we'll go back to him. Okay, Charlie, it's your turn.
Okay. Brian,
yes.
you said something about the Social Security. We have to do something about Social Security, and you call it an entitlement, I believe.
Yes.
Okay. Social Security was something I paid for.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. Now, the thing that I like about what you said is we should go to the Chilean type of a retirement plan. So
yes.
I've heard about it, but I can't remember it. So would you go ahead and explain what the Chilean does? Because it sounds like something that would improve the Social Security system in America, to where senior citizens will be better protected with it in the future if we were to go to something like that and combine it with our Social Security plan.
Yeah, actually, you know, that's a great question. The Chilean model, what they did in the country of Chile is they went to a private account system about 35, 40 years ago now. They went to a private account system, and they actually made it a hybrid system. They gave the citizens an option to stay in the public plan, the public pension system, which is the equivalent of our Social Security. Or they gave them the opportunity to take their contributions and to put them into private accounts. These accounts were set up with various insurance companies in the country of Chile. The investment parameters were mandated by the government, but they gave the people the opportunity to put their money in a private account system. What happened was, after the first 10 years, 93% of the Chilean citizens moved to the private option. They moved out of the public option and went to the private account system. Today, they have more in their retirement accounts than, quite frankly, our seniors have in theirs. Because the truth is, our seniors don't have anything in their retirement accounts. Because the money that our seniors paid has been spent by reckless politicians. And so today what's happening is what was happening in Social Security is that current workers are paying current benefits. Well, my grandmother is 94 years old. I'm paying her Social Security. This is not money that's coming from the Social Security administration. This is money that's coming from the United States Treasury from current tax receipts or current borrowings. So right now, Social Security is being funded primarily by tax receipts through the withholding tax. Secondarily, it's being funded by borrowings. So basically what you have is you have current and future Americans paying for retirement benefits today. And that's a system that simply cannot stand going forward. So I think it's a great time to bring that debate again of private accounts and Social Security. But the key is you have to have a leadership who can articulate that and won't be afraid when the slings and arrows come, because they're going to come. Because the left is not going to want to change Social Security, because it provides them a power base for elections. And so you have to be willing to stand up and speak truth to power in that regard. And that's why I think the Chilean model is a good option for us to look at when it comes to reforming Social Security here in America. With respect to Social Security, I think you have to raise the retirement age. For those who are under the age of 55, it does have to go up, because we don't have enough workers to supply the amount of revenue necessary to pay these Social Security benefits. It just doesn't exist. It's not possible.
Then I suggest doing a voluntary system to get it going, and then hopefully maybe half of the people will see the benefit of it, especially if you start pushing how good, well it works in Chile.
That's right. You know, a lot of things, you know, if we can just get started with a lot of these programs, the American people would follow them actually beautifully. I mean, look at what's happened in Wisconsin. There are reports coming out of Wisconsin, number one, that Governor Walker's collective bargaining reforms have been a boon to local economies, because now they're not having to plug large budget gaps, or they're not having big budget gaps. They're actually having budget surpluses now in some of the local economies and local governments in the state of Wisconsin. can in the state of Wisconsin because of collective bargaining reform. And the latest polling shows that he's actually not going to be going anywhere if the latest polling holds up. That's a great win, a huge win for the forces of smaller government in America.
Right.
Because it gives us the opportunity to demonstrate what's possible when we actually follow through with sound economic policy. Now, the one thing I would recommend to Republicans is don't just let this victory in Wisconsin that is happening, don't let that victory just fall on deaf ears. Anytime we talk about any other policy prescription we have for preserving America, we have to use Wisconsin as our model for the rest of the country. Look what we did in Wisconsin. We can do the same thing across the country, and that's why we're right. And that's why it goes back to, it's not enough just to say, oh, well, I voted this way and I voted that way. That's not enough anymore. You have to be willing to be an advocate for these policies and for these principles to the American people.
Well, you know, the idea of getting back to that Chilean thing, it seems to me like that system, if I'm not mistaken, could possibly work on a state-by-state basis.
It could.
Where they don't have to rely on the federal government at all. This would be like started in there and then slowly build it up and then go ahead and have your Social Security money transferred over. But I'm just saying is there are a lot of people in this country who could probably afford starting something like the Chilean thing.
Yes. I will go one step further. You said breaking it down to state levels. We could probably break it down to the individual level, which would be a phenomenal thing. It would be absolutely phenomenal. I mean, but that's a path we have to begin to walk down. The first place, of course, is having major Social Security reform, and I think the Chilean model is a great place to start.
Do you know the biggest reform that I want to hear you talk about is illegal alien reform, welfare reform, putting people back to work? Because I cannot see giving a credit card, an EBT card, to people who smoke, drink, or do drugs, and there's no backup to it. In other words, they are not questioned on it.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. I believe that it should be done on a local basis, and not necessarily through the government, like even through the schools or something like that, to where the person who is getting this actually reports, or there's a family that, or somebody, people that need jobs, they will go door to door and deliver the EBT cards to the people, because that way they can go ahead and see just what kind of living conditions they have. Because if it looks like they're drinking, smoking, and all this type of thing, our tax dollars should not go for their expensive smoking habits, drinking habits, or drug habits. It should go strictly for healthy foods for the family.
Listen. I completely agree with that. The biggest, you know, the biggest thing we have to do, let's talk about the food stamp program first. I still call it the food stamp program. I know they try to call it SNAP, but it's the food stamp program. The biggest thing about the food stamp program that has to change actually happens in schools. You know, if you are on the food stamp program, the school districts know that. And they also allow the kids of people who are on the food stamp program to qualify for free lunch. Now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
If you're already being provided a food stipend, how is it that the school districts are then signing your kids up for the free lunch program? That doesn't make any sense, because you're already getting public assistance for food. So you should be able to provide your kids with lunch. The reason why that's happening is because government is not paying attention to the money being spent in the school district versus what's being spent in the food stamp program. They're just throwing the money out the window to see whatever sticks. And so that's one of the primary reforms we have to have with the food stamp program. The second thing, I think, when we talk broader about welfare benefits, I do agree, and I think it was wrong that it was overturned here in the state of Florida, that you should have to pass random drug tests if you're going to be on public assistance. Because you're taking money from your fellow citizens, not from the government. That's the money of your neighbors.
The citizens are the government.
That's right. It's the money, and it is the property of citizens that is being redistributed to you. So there must be a burden of proof. There must be a burden of, there must be a standard that you have to maintain if you're going to receive those benefits. That, to me, that just seems only right and fair to all parties involved. Furthermore, it puts an onus on you, the receiver, to actually have to do something other than just be in need. Okay, now, with respect to immigration, because I'm a tie welfare spending into immigration as well, one of the things we have to do is end welfare spending for people who are here illegally. I think you have to do that simply because we don't have money. You know, like I said, with Social Security, we are, how Social Security is being paid for is with current workers and with future people yet to be born or work through borrowing. And we're doing the same thing with welfare benefits to people who are here illegally. If we're going to have a welfare state, you cannot have an open border society. The two can never mix, because what you will do is you'll have a system where the world's poor will always come to your country to take advantage of the welfare state. And it'll become so burdensome it'll collapse the society. And that's exactly what's happening today. So in my view, if you're going to maintain public assistance for our citizens, you have to end welfare benefits to people who are here illegally. It has to be a deterrent to them from coming here, because if it's easy for them to come and to feed their families, they're going to come and feed their families. The second thing I think we have to do is we have to change birthright citizenship, which doesn't get talked about a lot with immigration policy. But I think we need to go to an immigration policy where one of your parents must be a United States citizen. United States citizenship has to be sacred, and right now it's not, because we have people, we have foreign nationals coming over here, living in homes for 6 months, giving birth to their children. The children automatically get United States citizenship, and then they go back to their host country. We have businesses propping up in our major communities around that. So I think that's the other thing you have to do with immigration. Furthermore, I think that birthright citizenship is an abomination to the 14th Amendment, because the 14th Amendment was designed for the children of black slaves, for black slaves. It was not designed for people just coming over our borders and gaining citizenship that way. That is not the purpose and the premise of the 14th Amendment. So that's another reason why I oppose birthright citizenship as it exists today.
I agree with you on that one, 100%.
The last thing thing I think you do is then you actually enforce the laws. I do support a guest worker program. I don't think mass deportation can work, simply because you basically would have to increase the size of government in order to have mass deportation. We can't get rid of the waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare. I don't see how we could ever logistically deport 10 million people out of the country. I think if you put in those three instances with welfare reform for illegals, with a change to birthright citizenship, and with a guest worker status, if you can prove you can be in this country and work, I don't have a problem with you being here and working. You're not going to get welfare benefits because you're not a citizen. You're not going to be able to vote. There's not going to be a pathway to citizenship, but you can come here and work. I don't have a problem with that. And what will happen is that the people who are not productive but are here illegally, they will go home, because there'll be nothing here for them.
I got to chime in real quick on that, because there's already multiple guest worker programs. So that the notion that there isn't that is very misleading. I think it was Lou Dobbs who reported in the past that there was something like 20 or 30 different ones. So there are guest worker programs. But that's not what the illegals are going to. The illegals don't follow the path of the guest worker program. And the other part of this, and I agree, there's no way you're just going to go, okay, for the 20, 30 million of you who are here illegal, step up so we can deport you. I mean, obviously that's not going to happen. But if we get serious about actually enforcing the current immigration laws, most of them would go home on their own, because they would have no place to work. They would have no driver's license. They wouldn't be able to play the system the way they do if we enforce the current immigration law. Sorry, I just had to kind of cut in and chime in.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Yeah, I completely – you have to – and then you have to enforce immigration law, like you said. The other thing I would do is I think you have to reform the HB1 visa program. I think for foreign nationals who have definable skills, that has to be – it's something where, you know, we have to allow people who can work and have important skills to the future of American society. They should be able to come here a lot more easily than they come right now. That program.
Well, and on that one too. One more quick chime in on that one, because I work in the IT industry. I know there's plenty of H-1B visas. It's another program that gets abused, bringing H-1B visas in for people to do housekeeping at hotels. that's not what I would call a high skill set that you should be importing people. But that's just part of the way they play the game. So when you want to talk about H-1B visas, give me a call because I work in IT and I know I can tell you a lot about what's happening in the real world out there in that area.
Absolutely. I look forward to that conversation.
Okay. I'm sorry, Charlie. Go ahead.
No, I'm okay.
Okay. Well, if you're ready for me to ask one other question, well, we've still got a couple other things here, and we've got about 15 minutes left. So I'm going to go ahead and throw one out there in reference to the financial situation where we're talking about the financial institutions such as the Federal Reserve. I happen to believe Ron Paul would be the best treasurer we could ever have in this country, and I would wish, you know, if Romney had a brain in his head, he'd be out there trying to push something like that, but I don't think Romney has a brain in his head. That's another story. But the Federal Reserve, how much do you understand this whole fiscal policy? Ron Paul's been saying we need to get rid of this Federal Reserve years ago. How many billions of dollars, trillions of dollars were out there bailing out foreign banks when we're bankrupt ourselves? The whole thing's pretty nuts. What about the banking Federal Reserve piece of it?
I think you have to, first thing with the Federal Reserve we got to do is take away one of their mandates. I think they have to be just responsible for sound money policy. They can't be responsible for inflation, and they can't be responsible really for the economy in general. I think they just have to be responsible for sound money. The second thing we got to do is I do think we have to audit the Federal Reserve, and that's something that only the Congress can do. I think it can't be pushed out to some agency. I think it's not something that you can just have Treasury do. It's got to be done under the purview of Congress. By the way, I think Ron Paul will make an excellent Treasury Secretary, by the way. I think he would. Those would be some actual very interesting hearings, and confirmation hearings would be excellent. But that's I think it would be must-see TV, actually. But that's me. With respect to the Federal Reserve, I think those are the two things that have to happen first. Once you have a good handle on everything the Federal Reserve is actually doing, and you actually take down their mandate to just sound money, then you can begin the process of getting rid of the Federal Reserve, if that's what we feel we need to do. Of course, the Federal Reserve doesn't have constitutional authority, like a lot of things in American society that don't have constitutional authority, but it does exist. I do not support a wholesale jettisoning of the Federal Reserve, even though it might be a bad system. In my experience, just on a micro level, if you're dealing with a bad system, you can't just throw it in the trash because you're gonna create dislocation for yourself. I think you have to really begin to look at what your issue is, look at alternatives, really understand those, and then go through the process of swapping out systems. Now, with respect to current, what other currency alternatives that we can do, I'm not 100% versed on that, but I can't speak on it. But with respect to the Federal Reserve, I do think that those are the three actions we have to begin to do first: take away one of their mandates, audit it, and then begin the process of removal.
Well, that sounds great.
Okay, I got something.
Go ahead.
Okay, I've heard that Spain is going to count the vote. What do you think of that in regards to the constitutional rights of we the people?
Spain is going to count the vote of what?
November, the general election. That's what I've heard. Because
that Spain is going
to? Yeah, because yeah. The company that made the computers for here in the States was purchased by the company in Spain. So now, somehow, right, the rumor is that Congress is going to allow them to count our votes, and our votes are supposed to be counted by we the people.
Well, honestly, I got to go and read that whole thing. But on the face of it, I don't like that at all, to be honest with you. And there's no reason that we have to rely on a foreign company at this point to be able to tabulate our own votes here. I know it's done on a computer system and it's done here, and that's why I gotta say I have to look at the particulars, but on the face of it, I'm not gonna be a fan of this thing with Spain being involved in
right.
The electoral college votes here in America. I don't like the sound of that.
And
that's something
also,
I have to do a lot more research on.
Right. And also, how do you write in a candidate on a computer? There's no way to write somebody in, and therefore, you know, because of the illegal monopoly of the Democrat and Republican parties, as in our complaint, we should be able to write in anybody we want on for any office. And we should not have to rely on the Democrat Party, Republican Party telling us who's running and deny us the right to vote for John Doe down the street if we want. Who knows? At the last minute, John Doe may wind up getting 50,000 people to vote for him because he said the right thing at the right time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he could wind up winning it, but there's no place to write his name in unless you write over somebody else. But see, there's one thing that has to be done. The laws have to be changed.
Well, you know, well, with respect to write-ins, I guess the question is that will a write-in be counted in the computer system? I mean, I know when I go vote, they do have the line for write-in down here in Southwest Florida. I'm just not familiar with how it operates in Orange County or what the process is when they actually go to tabulate those votes. That's the part where I'm not 100% versed in.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, our vote's got to be protected at all costs, and the whole thing is it looks like our elected officials in Congress don't give a darn. As long as they're, because it seems like it's all swung so that they will be reelected regardless.
Well, they do everything they can to block the no party affiliate or the third party. The game is rigged. There's no two ways about it, and that's again why we did the FBI complaint, which hopefully I think we'll have enough time to maybe talk about it for just a couple of minutes. You know, because in Orange County, we do have those paper ballots where it's a laser reader kind of thing. So at least in my precinct, that's what I've always had. Early voting is another deal. They play games with the early voting, and I think it's ridiculous to be out there voting for 2 weeks in advance. You should never have that kind of stuff. So when it comes to the election process, I mean, anybody that thinks American elections are clean, I mean, they've got to have their head so far in the sand. That maybe just their feet are sticking up out of the ground. I don't know. But because our elections are so corrupt, and we've got to do something to clean up that process. And Charlie was starting to talk about the complaint, and I think I mentioned something to you guys before you came on the show. I think I'd sent some information to you, and I think Charlie gave it to you at the Florida homeschooling convention.
Yeah.
We the People versus the Ballot Box Establishment. I don't know if you had a chance to look at that and if you had any questions or comments on it.
No, I didn't have a chance to look at it, but from understanding it, when I heard Charlie going through it earlier on, yeah, I disagree with the whole qualifying process. And I mean, you know, I was fortunate enough to qualify with the help of a great team down here, and we just had a phenomenal team. It was a total team effort to qualify. But, you know, there's something very wrong when you can just cut a check for $10,000 to go on a ballot. And when I was out getting petitions, I was explaining to independents and to Democrats and to Republicans, you know, average people, saying, listen, I need your help to get on this ballot. And they're like, well, I don't know you. And I would tell them point blank. I said, listen, there are going to be people on that ballot. Now, at least you could have had the opportunity to at least meet me and decide if you want me on a ballot or not. But my opponents, they're just going to cut a check for $10,000. Or they're going to hire a bunch of interns to basically walk around and get petitions signed all day long. Or they're going to hire a company to go out and just get petitions signed. I mean, that's how this thing works now in Florida. And I think that's to a detriment of the citizenry. It should not be that high of a hurdle to get on a ballot. I completely disagree with that. Furthermore, I also don't agree that it should feed the parties. The fee to go on the ballot should feed the parties. You know, I think people should be able to freely get on the ballot if they so choose to run for political office, and it becomes a requirement of the people to decide who should be the elected candidate and who should not.
Well, I like your views on it because that's why Sally and I filed this complaint, and Sally and I will be discussing that at great length this week because we have to make a decision. Since we haven't heard from the FBI yet as to what they're doing, as to what we are going to do, because we may have to implement Plan B. Plan A was to go ahead and get the FBI to do their job for the good of the people of Central Florida and the United States, just like they did in Cuyahoga County, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
They got 35 indictments against the county commissioner. 33 were jury convictions. He's spending a lot of time in prison, and now they're going after another member of the commission. And that's what we wanted them to do here because of all of this commuter rail system that John Mike is involved in, but they haven't come back to us yet, and they've had it for a month starting Monday.
You know, you mentioned something about commuter rail. Commuter rail is one of the great disasters in history. You know, I'm from New York. I'm from Brooklyn. The MTA is a huge transit system in New York City, and as big as it is, as highly used as it is, they always have lost money. They always have lost money. Since I was a kid, the MTA has lost money, so much so that they always have to raise the rider fees. You know, I was in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and we took the MARC train from the whatever they call their train system. We got on the MARC and rode that out to BWI to hop a plane back down here. And so we're on the MARC Amtrak train. I'm sitting with one of the guys on my campaign, and we're riding. And I tell him, I said, look around you. I said, do you know why high speed rail or light rail doesn't work? And he's like, why? I was like, look at this train. This thing would have to be full all the time for them to even begin to be able to make it work economically. That's why commuter rail always fails. And in Florida, it would have been the biggest disaster for the state. Probably, well, not as big as Medicaid is on the state, but it would have been a huge disaster for the state if that actually happened here.
And this one here is only going 60 miles.
Yeah. See, that's
going 60 miles, and it's not even going to be near I-4 to reduce the traffic on. This is John Micah's way of getting money for CSX, who have given him over $70,000 since he's been running for office. They wanted that money to build a new rail yard in Lakeland.
Yeah.
And they violated the rights of we the people at the ballot box, because at the ballot box we said no. Seven people overthrew us.
More than seven.
An overthrow of the sovereign. An overthrow of the sovereign is an act of treason, and I don't care what they say.
Okay, and just so, Byron, we're talking about the, it's called SunRail, we call it ScamRail.
Yeah.
It's about the high-speed train thing. We were able to get shut down, but you had two Republicans, so-called conservatives, Rubio and Micah, standing right there to cut the ribbon with Obama, and Micah being the one who has been pushing this stuff for 20 years, and, you know, anything to do with this mass transit is truly all part of Agenda 21 as well, the sustainable development. But in the case of John Micah, he strictly is out there for his CSX friends, and it's nothing. It's such a boondoggle. But you as a Republican, I'm going to ask you here again, this is where this Republican stuff drives me up a tree. It was a bunch of Republicans who let this happen, and Charlie makes mention of seven individuals. The Orange County Commission, after many town hall meetings and a public referendum and everything else, and we all said no, they said, we don't care what you said, we're going to fund it anyway, we're going to spend $44 million to study it some more and then go ahead and do what we feel like doing. But you also had those in Tallahassee who did it, and then you also had those in Congress who did it, and all Republicans. It was Republicans who squandered this money. So when is the Republican Party going to show some kind of conservative fiscal responsibility? And when is somebody going to take action against John Micah to stop him, because he's the chair of the Transportation Committee up there?
Well, this goes back to the way I view government. It really does. You know, there's always going to be a couple of guys like me up there who are going to try to shout from the mountaintops and be like, hey, this is wrong, we got to stop this. But without the will of the people behind us, to be frank, it's not going to matter. Because there's always going to be, but hear me out on this. Without the people, and this is where leadership comes into play. Without the people to actually care about their politics, it's not going to matter. And I truly believe that. That's why for me, it's not so much to say, oh, well, I'm a congressman now and I passed this and I did this business. No, you have to try to rally the electorate to understand why liberty is crucial and why it is the job of the politician to pay attention to the people, not for them to just be doing their thing. And it's also not the job of the people to not pay attention to these things. Like, you're paying attention to it. Charlie's paying attention to it. But the people of Florida have
yelled loud and clear that they don't want it. The people of Florida have voted multiple times on scam rail, high-speed scam rail. I mean, we have said no.
Yes.
We have got a group of elected public servants who said, we don't care. We're going to shove it in your face, whether you like it or not, and we're going to send you the bill for it. And that's exactly what's happened. We're down to 3 minutes here, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Charlie, did you want to get something real quick in there?
Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I'd rather let the candidate say his goodbye. God bless America.
Thank you. Okay. Well, and one last wrap up for you.
Well, again, you know, Charlie, thank you so much. Sally, thank you so much. You know, if you're listening tonight, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this show. Continue to support it, because you have good hosts here who are trying to get you the information you need to really take control of your politics. This whole process, all the things we talk about here tonight, it becomes very, very hard without your involvement and without you being an advocate in your communities. And if you get anything from any of the things that I talked about today, just please know that it's a requirement of you and your community. It's a requirement of me and my community to be a rallying point for our fellow citizens so we can have a federal government that is limited and is defined and respects the individual liberty of all people. That is what's going to preserve America for the next 100 years. It's not going to be Mitt Romney. It's not going to be Barack Obama. It's not even going to be Ron Paul. It's going to be the people deciding that they've had enough and they're going to control their politics. I'm running for Congress because I want to be an advocate for these principles. I want to help to rally the American people to these causes so we can decide what nation we want. With that, I need your help. If you can help me out in my campaign, please go to my website, ByronDonalds.com. Follow me on Twitter, @ByronDonalds. Follow me on Facebook, Facebook.com/ByronDonalds. I need your help. I'm running against some entrenched people here in Southwest Florida who think that this is their seat just because they've shown up. But it's not theirs. It's the people's seat. So I just want to thank you so much for your time. I want to thank you for listening. Once again, my website is ByronDonalds.com. Join our team. Help us out. Donate to our campaign. And I want to thank you so much for listening tonight.
Well, thank you so much. This has been an excellent interview, and you can leave it out there as an archive. You can link it. People can come listen to it. It'll be out there through the elections in plenty of time. So please let them send them a link and let them play it if they were not able to tune in. And on that note, excellent discussion. And tune in on Monday. We will be here. We'll be talking about the issues of the day, American Statesman Blog Talk Radio, and we hope everybody has a very safe and happy good evening. And as always, may God bless the USA. Good night.